Right. Good afternoon, good morning, good evening to everybody. You've reached the right place. Cameron Cross's talk, webinar, The New Persian Romance in a Global Middle Ages. Cameron Cross is an assistant professor of Iranian studies at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. There he teaches classes on Persian literature, Iranian studies, and the culture and history of the Middle East more broadly. His research interests center on the literary traditions of the Nile to Oxus region, from about 800 to 1200 Christian era, that is 200 to 700 Hijri, though he himself also works in classical and late antique texts on one hand, but also early modern and modern texts on the other. His research interests include the comparative study of literature, theories of love, desire, and effect, animal and monster studies, and the social functions of poetry. His first monograph, Love at a Crux, was published by the University of Toronto Press in 2023. So I'm going to finish there and turn the floor physically and metaphorically over to Cameron, who will talk for whatever period of time he chooses to go on, and then we will take the balance of the time with the questions and answers. Cameron, off to you.
Well, thank you so much for coming, for inviting me. This is an honor. I see there's so many people here, and I'm really grateful for you spending your time to come and hear me talk a little bit about my book. I'm really excited to hear your questions too. So I'm going to set myself a timer so that I try not to go overboard and give you a quick overview in as to what this whole thing is about, so there's plenty of time for questions and discussion. So I thought I would start. This is a cover of the book, and I'd like to mention that it's also available online as a P open source PDF. So there's the DOI if you want to download it. And I thought I would frame the talk basically around the title and subtitle of the book. I'll say a few things about the genesis of the project, where it came from, and then I'll try to talk about the theoretical framing of what I mean by the new Persian romance in a global Middle Ages. And then the book itself is entitled Love at a Crux, and I'll explain what I mean by this idea of crux. And if there's time at the end, I'll say a few things about what I'm trying to build on this research moving forward. So to talk about the genesis of the project, it began. I actually want to start with a quick plug to Dick Davis for his amazing verse translation, which really opened my eyes to the kind of depth and potential and richness of this text to begin with. And it really got lit the fire on under me to get started on working on it in depth. And so the book focuses on this fairly obscure romance called Visu Ramin. I mean, it's obscure in some ways and not in other, and I'll explain what I mean. But for some quick context, it was written at the beginning of the Seljuk era, probably in the year 1054 or 446, by Fakhreddin Asad Gorgani. And it's often counted as one of the first major romances, or what's called the Dastan-e-Ashiqane in New Persian literature. It's quite distinctive in that the re story revolves around a love triangle between Vis, the princess, and two brothers, Ramin, who is the prince of the kingdom of Merv, and also her lover, and the older brother, Mobad, who is the king of Merv and her husband. It's probably a very old tale dating back to the first century CE. In the Parthian period, and it was commissioned by the Seljuk governor of Esfahan, Abul Fatih Muzaffer, as a kind of, he seems to have framed it as kind of, he wants to know more about the local culture of Esfahan. He himself is coming from Nishapur. It has a very interesting afterlife too. It was translated into Georgian about a century later as Vis Ramiani, and becomes a keystone text in the formation of the literary court literature of, or the court literature of the Georgian language. It has a tremendous influence on Nezami Ganjavi, even though he somewhat hides his debt to this text and sort of tends to frame it in negative ways. You also find numerous references to Visu Ramin as lovers in the works of figures like Iran Shah, Rumi, Attar, Emad Faqih, Khwaju Kermani, Obaid Zakani, and so on. And there's a few key, both stylistically, there's a few aspects of Visu Ramin that really do shape the direction of the romance in Persian, such as interiority and characterization, and also in this distinctive piece called the Dahname, the 10 letters, which is a series of letters Vis sends to Ramin, which is taken up as kind of becomes mode again in the 13th and 14th centuries, and a number of Muzaffarid and Injuid poets like Homam, Tabrizi, and Khwaju write their own Dahnames in imitation of that particular section. However, because of the love triangle aspect and a couple other fairly taboo aspects of the text, such as the open representation of adultery, a very frank depiction of female sexuality, a coup d'etat that happens where the king is overthrown, incest. These are all things that have traditionally marked the text as being somewhat of an outlier. And it doesn't help, words like cul-de-sac anomaly are also used. And it doesn't help that Nezami casts such a long shadow, such that his work after Ghorghanis becomes kind of the model to emulate. And you can see even here, even when Visvaramin is sort of recovered in the modern context, it is often framed as this sort of forgotten story that is really challenging and taboo-breaking in a sense. Here's the image here is from an artist who frames it, uses that as an inspiration for the story of a secret romance or lost memory, a forbidden document. Or in this title, we see here this, what does it say? This Eshkaye Faramushode, this idea of like sort of a story that has been put to the side and is not really part of the canon, so to speak. And so often this affects the way it's studied. It's treated as a kind of aberrant text, and it invites comparisons with other unusual aberrant texts, such as the Tristan and Isolde cycle. And these comparative projects often take the basis or take the form of source research, trying to decide, is there a relationship between these two texts because they are so strikingly similar? Or the other approach is to do this Ghorghani versus Nezami characterization or comparison. You put Visvaramin at the beginning of the romance tradition of Persian and then kind of walk down the road of that story of a linear movement through time where you start with the Visvaramin, and inevitably that sort of frames it as a clunky first start that is then perfected by Nezami and later writers. So I thought I would try to reapproach the text from a different frame. Instead of using a vertical or diachronic axis, I wanted to think of it laterally, horizontally, and synchronically. What's going on outside of Persian at this moment in time that would lead to some kind of striking resemblance between Visvaramin in Esfahan and the Tristan and Isolde cycle in Brittany. And by doing that, so I'm taking basically a trans-regional approach. And since I'm not interested in doing this kind of source research, I look rather at discourse analysis and looking at structure and thematic comparisons, which I describe as the mythos and ethos of romance. The mythos is the structure and the ethos is the kind of practices and habits that one finds within the structure. And the questions that this approach raises for me is, first of all, the very premise of the Persian romance to begin with. We sort of use this term consciously or unconsciously of the fact that it's a very Eurocentric term, very anachronistic. Can we talk about the Persian romance, or is that a viable category? If not, can we recognize it in comparative terms? Can we sort of approximate a Persian romance through a kind of comparative recognition? We sort of think we see something that we feel like we've seen before. And if we can recognize it as something that makes us think romance when we see it, does that help us recognize the very idea of what romance is? Does this offer a new story of the romance as a genre, one that might not be centered in Europe as so much as it typically is? So it does give us some questions, some insight into origins, where we see the huge importance of Greek and Arabic literatures in the emergence of Persian as a kind of new literary language that invites comparisons with the rise of European vernaculars or Caucasian vernaculars as literary languages, such as Georgian and Armenian, not necessarily as a new thing, but rather like new genres emerging in these languages. Even Middle Greek has this interesting moment, sort of efflorescence that takes place at this time. So this takes us to the idea of the global Middle Ages, which is a term very much in vogue right now. And so I'd like to describe a little bit about what I mean by that. Basically, what I perceive here is a kind of shift in Persian that mirrors or matches similar shifts taking place concurrently or pretty close in time in other literary languages. It's interesting here. I'll just read the English. This is the introduction to the text. where Gorgani introduces his story by saying that or Abul Muzaffar asks him, "Well, what do you know about the story of Isra-Ramin?" And he says, "Well, it's a lovely tale. Everyone in this realm adores it. Or sorry, it's a beautiful tale. It's compiled by six wise men. I've never seen a fairer story. Nothing like a garden in no, it's nothing like a garden in bloom. But its language is Pahlavi, Vadikan Pahlavi Bashan Zabanesh, and not everyone who reads it understands what it seeks to make clear. If a scholar were to put some work into it, it would become as beautiful as a mine full of gems." And I think what's really interesting is his focus on language, this idea of this Pahlavi language that the text is in. And a lot of the scholarship on Isra-Ramin up to this point has been dedicated to trying to unpack what he means by this very idea. What is his source text? But I'd like to sort of shift the focus to his phrase afterwards that agar donan dei darve baraz ranj gohar ganj. It becomes, if a scholar puts work into it, what happens? And so to contextualize this shift that Isra-Ramin seems to initiate or at least partake in, I'd like to backtrack by a few centuries to about the year 1000, where you find some interesting descriptions of narrative in the Fihrist or the catalog of Ibn Nadim, where he describes, when talking about the literature of the Persians, two categories, the Asmar, evening stories, and the Asmar Sahiha, the true evening stories. And if you look at the latter category, you find that a lot of this material is Shahnameh material or Sasanid Andarz literature, like advice literature. So you have things like the story of Rostam, the story of Bahram Chobin, the story of Anushirvan, books about royal protocol and customs. And this is a lot of the first Sasanian literature that's incorporated or translated into Arabic. It's basically narratives about kings and their customs that are of obvious and immediate importance to ruling elites. Compared to that are these evening stories, which are clearly sort of understood as a form of entertainment, something that you tell in the evening to relax. And here we find A Thousand Tales, The Bear and the Fox, animal fables, and these titles that even look a little bit like romances, Busifas and Philinus, which looks kind of Greek to me, Moshdone and Shah Zanon. These kind of pair couple-y sort of titles does make me think that romances or these love stories were also understood as part of this literature. And Ibn Nadim has like a whole section on books about lovers that he includes within this story. But when you shift back to the 10th century in the Samanid period, with the very first Masnavis being composed in the new Persian language, you find that the same pattern that we saw with the translation of Middle Persian texts into Arabic repeats itself with the translation, with the kinds of works that are sourced for this new courtly literature. It's all Shahnameh, advice literature, and biographies of famous heroes, kings, and prophets. And this takes us up basically to the year 1000 with Ferdowsi as the major turning point in this. After Ferdowsi, of course, his book is also a book of kings, and yet within it are many episodes that include love stories and other kinds of literature that would have been understood as Asmar in Ibn Nadim's category. But after Ferdowsi, we see a kind of this interesting bubble of poets, mostly based in Ghazna, who are interested in love stories. Unsuri is perhaps the most prolific and important of these three, although regrettably most of his work has been lost, but also Ayuri's Vargin Gul Shah, which is sourced from an Arabic love story, is there. And then shortly thereafter, Gorgani's Isra-Ramin kind of carries the baton forward. So it's this interesting turning point in the history of Persian literature where suddenly stories that were previously understood as being suitable for evening entertainment and not much more have a new life as prestigious works of verse. And I think going back to Gorgani's own perception of what he's doing, he's talking a lot about how the way this happens, the ingredient that changes this from entertainment to something that is beneficial to you, is sha'iri, is the act of like bringing poetry to this work, and thus bringing out ma'ani, these ideas of this sense of ideas through poetry. and that you can take something like a fasane or an afsane, which is kind of the Persian equivalent of samar or khorafa, this idea of a fairy tale. Fasane garche bashad naxu shirin bevasma bafie gardad no ayin. It becomes new. It becomes something novel and useful through this work of rhyme, meter, and meaning. And interestingly, this is the comparative angle. If you look laterally across this space, this development seems to be taking place concurrently with over this period of the next 100 years or so. This is kind of the first bubble of romances you find in Persian. But then 50 years later, we see further romance stories popping up in the Caucasus, also in Armenia now. If you move into the mid 12th century, suddenly in Middle Greek, you find all kinds of like sort of a resurgence of the ancient Greek novel in verse, which is new. Prose romances are appearing, the Samak Ayar, Thatalhema, which has romance elements in it. And then in Old French, Fleur en Blanche Fleur appears at the same time. And this is notably during the time of the Second Crusade. So there's a lot of physical back and forth between these various parts of the world. The Seljuks have been moving west and the Franks have been moving east, such that by the time you get to the year 1200, you have pretty much like this new genre emerging in multiple literary languages. And coincidentally, sort of the exemplars of the genre, Chrétien in French, for example, Shota Rostavelli in Georgian, Nezami in Persian, are all active at the same time, sort of laying down the foundation for what becomes a very important genre of literature afterwards. So scholars of comparative narrative have invited us to think of this comparative project, not necessarily as pure source criticism of like, what's the urtext that leads to all these later springs, but rather thinking about this kind of patchwork effect of multiple landscapes, cultural complexes that are contiguous with each other, and therefore come to display highly marked common ways of artistically and intellectually expressing similar preoccupations and needs. So it's global, not in a literal sense, I'm not talking about the actual globe, but rather a trans-regional, maybe hemispheric Afro-Eurasian sense, in which various practices of meaning-making are observable and comparable across these various literary traditions. And to describe this complex, this is not the only term that you could use, but I suggest the Helleno-Abrahamic complex, because these are across this wide stretch, these are areas where Greek philosophy or sort of Greek learning and Abrahamic prophecy, prophetic traditions are deeply important. And they're ambiently available to in the process of meaning making. And so romance then, I won't say that this is a romance, but we could think of it as a romance. We could recognize it as romance, as a kind of heuristic for exploring these trends across a kind of more broad comparative scope. So that's the new Persian romance in the global Middle Ages. And I'll wrap things up by talking a little bit about the content of like sort of the chapter breakdown of the book, although I'll try not to get too deep into the weeds. Why do I call it Love at a Crux? Basically, I see this being a product of this reframing that I was describing. By placing Iran at the center of this account, it decenters Europe for one thing, and sort of shows what happens when Iran is the site where all these older ingredients or elements, especially from Greek and Arabic and old Persian or Middle Persian, come together in the formation, kind of crucible, of this new style of romance telling. And when you look at it from that angle, you see that it's really here in the early 11th century that there's a crux or a turning point in which love stories and romances pick up a new life across this broad spectrum or across this broad transregional complex. At the same time as a text, and this is the reason why I focus on Viso Ramin in particular, as opposed to other early Persian romances, I feel that Viso Ramin is perhaps the most self-aware text in terms of the work it's doing to the genre. It's a lot of the stories of the individual characters in it kind of play with the conventions of the genre that it inherits, gives and puts it under a lot of stress tests to see what kinds of pitfalls, blind spots, impossibilities, emporia, exist within the sort of presumptions of the genre that can be teased out, interrogated, and perhaps reforged to produce something more intellectually rich. So it kind of crucifies the genre, it kind of tortures it, so to speak, by bringing it to a crux. And again, going back to Gorgani's own preface, our own language about what he describes, he introduces his text as a story that has many stories within it. Beguyam dastane ashagane bedudar eshkra chandin fasane. There's many stories within this dastane ashagane that invites a kind of novelistic reading, something akin to Bakhtin's Heteroglossia, where the Daye, the Ramin, and the Shah, the king, all have their perspectives, their sort of ways of seeing things, their images of the world that reveal themselves by looking at their language and their social position. So each chapter then focuses on one of these three main characters. First, starting with Vis, where I read, she seems very self-aware in terms of what she is supposed to do as a romance heroine, which is to be chaste and faithful to her beloved at all costs. And yet, again, like I was saying, the story kind of twists the opening or the framing of this classic story, this classic plot, in such a way that a successful and guilt-free resolution of it is impossible. No matter what she does some kind of sin. And while doing so, it and one of the main ways it does this is by introducing this really interesting proliferation of mirror images, such that Vis and Shahru look are mirror images of each other, the mother and the daughter, or her Vis's brother Viru, her first husband, and Ramin, her lover, are mirror images of each other. So it raises this question of if you are in love with Ramin and then you introduce Ramin's doppelganger, can you fall in love with the doppelganger exactly the same way? So it produces, it plays a lot with theories of vision and love and ethics, and thus leads to this interesting paradox where the only way that Vis can be faithful is by committing adultery. But she's aware of this, and she describes in one memorable passage, she says, Hamam yara so ham shu ham barodar, manas har se hamisus ham barozar. I have a brother, a husband, and a lover, and from all three, I burn in fire. Mobad, interestingly, is a kind of mirror image, sort of the male reverse side of the coin to Vis, where he also is in an impossible situation. And he even echoes her words, saying, Hame sale, hame suzam barazar, se daste daye o Vis o barazar. Quoting Vis, basically, to say, I too burn in fire at the hands of these three people. Who have put me in a situation where I'm the most, even though paradoxically I'm the king of kings, I am the most helpless of all the characters in the story. And again, this is manifested through doubling, through interior kinds of doubling. And here I'd borrow from Kantorovich's The King's Two Bodies a bit, but more importantly, maybe from the myth of Jamshid, who is both the king and the priest, and brings together this kind of tension between the perfect manhood and perfect kingship. But manhood, as we know, is mortal. People age and die, whereas kingship is eternal. And so there's this kind of rift that emerges between these two images of a perfect masculinity. It's also embedded in the polyphony or polysemy of the word mer, which can mean the sun. It can also mean love. It can also mean contract. And that Mobad is sort of attaches himself to all these meanings, such that when he makes a contract or a band with Shahru, he projects his authority, but then in so doing subjects himself to that authority, such that he becomes subject to his own contract. He's trapped by his own image, and this renders him impotent symbolically in the same way that his body is rendered impotent through a talisman. And thus he's in this strange situation where the mandated violence of kingship, such as punishing those who break contract, produces harm in him. It destroys his own legitimacy as a king. So it has this kind of strange in-between state of knowing and not knowing, or aware and unaware act of suicide or self-castration. And then finally with Ramin, he's also kind of, he deviates from the script a bit, he's described in one passage as like, why would you choose him? He's not an ideal person for the beloved in these stories. All he knows is how to string up a tambour and strum some melody on it. No one sees him except roaring drunk, pawning his clothes to the wine cellars. And here we get this another interesting tension between the kind of classic prose love story that one finds in the Greek novels and Arabic prose akhbar texts, and this insertion of the lyric mode of the ghazal in particular through the figure of Ramin. And even though the text does not include actual ghazals, Ramin sort of embodies the world of thought that the ghazal plays with and takes that sort of that all the conventions that one assumes or brings to the picture when reading ghazal. And so I try to theorize a little bit what is going on here, such as with the term mode switching, that it's he sort of introduces a change of mode, riffing off the idea of code switching, a sort of new language. And that he sort of takes the worldview, the nazar or the theoria of the lyrical tradition, which is not uniform, of course, but there's certain kinds of conventions that one recognizes, and brings them and sort of releases them into the wild of the narrative of the Masnavi with unexpected consequences. And here's an example of like an abstracted ghazal that I was sort of talking about, where he doesn't perform a ghazal formally, but his sonority, for the sake of time, I won't read it, but you can see how he uses the same end rhyme over and over and over in a way that makes one think of the sonority of the matla in the first rhyme, or the first line of a ghazal. And it sort of identifies the speech act as being, as having a certain sonic quality that makes one think of the ghazal. And so it's a kind of as if ghazal. And of course, because of his particular way of seeing things is so different from Vise's, even though they use the same words like vafa, like fidelity, it means very different things to the two of them. And so it produces this kind of unprecedented breakdown in the love story, which is that Vise and Ramin break up, essentially. They fall out of love. And you've never, there's, this is truly unprecedented in the love story romance tradition. It's the expectation is that the lovers will be faithful to each other through thick and thin, and either get married at the end of the story or die in the attempt. So to have the breakdown, the love revealed as something that is not eternal and subject to historical change, introduces a new facet, which is this idea of metatextuality, of historicity within the story. They're sort of aware of its own history. And so how do they secure their memory outside of the story itself? Ramin does this through, again, his identification with the lyric tradition. He says, I'm one of the Gariban. And you can sort of hear him nodding to fellows like Majnun in so doing. Whereas Vise describes herself as a sort of, as leaving behind a bodily testament, both in terms of her written words and her physical body itself. Most famously, this takes us back to the Dahnameh, where she writes her kind of testament and sort of inscribes herself into history, even by addressing, both through like these remarkable verbal performances, and also addressing the readers of the story themselves, saying like, remember me, I am a historical figure who can bear testament to what, to the injustices of Ramin, because Ramin betrays her and marries another woman. So to wrap up, it's a really interesting story, and it seems to, in carving out a new way of telling romance, it also suggests the possibility of death and change within the premise of romantic love, or the practice of romantic love, that it can't be, it's not a static thing the way that Bakhtin or Foucault sort of read it, where it's just like this timeless love that's unchanged from the moment of meeting to the moment of consummation, but rather something that needs work, it needs management, and a kind of active practice of what it means to be in the lover, that raises new questions that the previous iterations of the genre hadn't explored as fully. And in so doing, by raising this question of like, basically, how does one act historically in the world as a subject, it introduces new tensions or new kinds of methods of thinking about the world that are also kind of distinctive for this time period. as other scholars have noted, this is a time period where rhetoricians and philosophers are thinking about fantasy, tahil, image making, as something perhaps more than just flights of fancy, but rather a kind of serious practice through which one can create bridges to the real through the practice of metaphor, majaz, through mental images that are not necessarily true historically, but can be true in terms of they can offer glimpses of truth, even though they're not technically historical. It sort of treads this line between the famous opening yeki bud, yeki nabud. It was and it wasn't. It has a dose of reality, but it also is unreal, and yet it can't be discounted as being worthless. So it's I think I'll close with that. My favorite line from the story might be how Guarani, as an author, sort of self-reflectively thinks about his own role as a storyteller, and how that becomes sort of the next layer of meaning making, in which telling stories becomes story, becomes history. I'll read this passage and then close. He writes at the end of the story, Choma as raftagan girim akhbar, sema farda khabar girand nachar. Khabar gardim o ma bude khabar jui, semar gardim o bud bude semar gui. Just as we take tidings from those who have passed, tomorrow they will certainly take them from us. In seeking a story, we become one ourselves. In telling a tale, we pass into legend. So thank you. I'll stop my presentation here, and I'd love to hear your questions. I can share a few words about what I'm working on now if you're curious to hear about it, but I'll be glad to take the conversation in any direction you like.
That's great, Cameron. Thank you so very, very much. Could I just ask, as a non-specialist in this area, I found this absolutely fascinating. You mentioned Nizami, with whom I'm slightly, considerably more familiar, even though that doesn't say a great deal. And I'm wondering what, as an example, what is the post-contemporary reception interpretation work with this particular poem and tradition? And again, the example that I latched onto was that of Nizami.
When you say post-contemporary, tell me what you mean?
What did he do? You alluded to it at the beginning, and I thought, oh, I know something about Nizami. Mm. What could you unpack that a little bit?
Sure. In fact, let me flag for you a book that came out a few years ago called Esordi del Romanzo Persiano, I think, by Nahi Nowruzi, where I've been reading it right now, and it offers a very detailed account, sort of comparing and contrasting how Nizami, even though he doesn't give Ghorghani much credit, he seems like he wants to kind of fix Ghorghani's take on the story. He draws from Ghorghani basically at every level. Specific passages are cited, even, or like you get this kind of tazmin or istiqbal of certain passages where you find them quoted and slightly reworked from the text. Whole scenes are lifted from Ghorghani's work, such as the debate in the snowstorm. There's not a Dahname, but there is a debate of the two minstrels that has something kind of, it sort of recasts that debate genre in its own way. The theme of the love triangle is sort of multiplied by Nizami. I like to call it like a love hexagon, because on one hand you have Khosrow, Shirin, and Maryam, and then on the other hand you have Shirin, Khosrow, and Farhad. And so he takes that device and plays with it to produce new kinds of statements or ideas around what the ideal love relationship ought to look like and what it does to lovers, with different points of emphasis. And so Nowruzi's book chapter is absolutely fantastic for this. I learned a lot by reading it.
Okay, I would normally follow up, but I've got some questions already. Could you tell us some more about what you're working on now and what your future research is? So taking you up on that offer.
Sure. Would you like me to share my slides again?
If you like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, okay. Can you see my Sapase Faravan? So after that, I did have a few things. So what I'm working on right now, so like I said, this Ghorghani is not the only one writing love stories in Persian verse in Masnavi. His predecessors, Abul Ghassem Onsori and Ayuri, are both extremely interesting cases. And so I've been working on article projects that are at various stages of development. This is Onsori's Vamekho Azra, of which we only have fragments. And yet it's clear that this is an actual translation of a Greek text that was written 1,000 years prior. Like you can find line for line like comparisons, and so it raises really interesting questions about translation, about the representation of ancient Greek culture for Mahmud al-Ghazna. And I'm aware of the fact that contemporaneously Abu Rihan Biruni is also writing about what's in India and talking about kind of other forms of non-Abrahamic religious or philosophical traditions. So it's been really interesting as a way, and this text itself talks a lot about Hermes, the famous sage. So it seems to have a lot to say about knowledge systems that exist in cultures outside the kind of sanctioned orbit of Abrahamic revelation. And like, how does one encounter these cultures? How does one bring them in and sort of native localize them in a way that is useful for somebody like Mahmud? So there's that work that I've been playing with. And then Ayuri's Vargen Golsha is also an extremely important text. And I feel unfortunately also a bit overshadowed by Ferdowsi. The art historians are doing amazing work on this because it's an extremely important document, this manuscript, which is from the mid 1200s and was made in Konya. It has the first representations of the Prophet Muhammad, for example, and all kinds of other really interesting figurative aspects to it. But from the lens of translation, again, this is a text that has a clear predecessor in Arabic literature, the story of Urwan and Afra, which was narrated by the likes of Ibn Qutayba, Abu Faraj al-Isfahani. Al-Mas'udi has a version of it. So you can see how Ayuri literally takes the Arabic source and turns it into Persian verse. What elements does he add to it? How does he play with it? And he also incorporates actual ghazals in the text in a way that Gorgani only sort of abstractly does. We have headings that say shir, and then the first person voice of various characters in the story speaking out and even dialoguing with each other, because their poems often share the same radif. So for anyone interested in intertextuality or dialogism or heteroglossia, this is a really, really interesting text. So I'm working on a translation/edition of it. Here's a page of it. It's just been really fun to work on. It's also really interesting from the perspective of archaic Persian and orthography. So those are two things I'm working away on.
Terrific. Okay, thank you very much. Here's a question about later authors addressing the fascinating issue of falling out of love. Could you unpack that a little bit?
That's really good. So I've read a lot of romances, but I still feel like there's so many more I need to read before I can say for sure. But I think it's really rare to find a love story of this mold where the love breaks down. Even when looking at something like, there's love is subjected to crisis in a story like Hosro and Shirin, but it's not like Shirin, even though she holds Farhad in such high esteem and Farhad loves her so unconditionally, it's never really a question, I don't think. Does Shirin really love Khosro? It's always like, yes, that they're meant for each other. That's the story. And then later love stories, such as Khwaju Kermani's Humayun Humayun, it just takes for granted that they are going to be consistently in love with each other. So it's really kind of strangely, here it is a bit of an outlier, I would say. It's kind of strangely modern to see an actual breakdown of, it's something that one expects in kind of novelistic literature of the 19th, 20th centuries. And of course, like it's sort of like, it's not a final breakdown. Things collapse to the point that they can. And then in this kind of snowstorm scene, which seems like a death moment for both of them, like they're literally at rock bottom, about to die in the snow, you get a divine intervention, basically a dragon in the form of the snow takes the form of a dragon and sort of swoops in and terrifies Ramin away from leaving Vis forever to die in the snow, and he comes back and says, I'm sorry, and they get back together and things are brought to a happy end. but only through this kind of symbolic death and breakdown, and through a political revolution where Mobad is deposed, is killed off, also through a kind of divine intervention, and the new order is set in place. So I think there, again, the author seems to be very intentionally working with the expectations of his readers to suggest what romantic love is all about. It's really not just a evening tale. It's about a whole new order of political and social relations.
Okay, thank you very much. Can we determine the extent to which Gorgoni had access to a new Persian version of the story that was in circulation of the region, or if it had not yet been translated from the Middle Persian?
Yeah, there's a ton of literature on this. A ton, a ton, a ton. It's a long debate, and I can recommend two sources if you want the whole bibliography on this. My own article, "The Lives and Afterlives of Veysel Ramin," sort of goes through that literature, and more recently, Nahid Nowruzi's book goes through it in more detail, very comprehensively. I think that the general consensus is that it seems likely that Gorgani was working from some kind of prose crib, perhaps, of the that was written in New Persian based off of Pahlavi. It doesn't seem far-fetched to imagine that he has some sort of familiarity with Middle Persian for various reasons. He likes to show off his own etymological chops, for example, where he describes the Middle Persian meaning of Khorasan, for example. But given kind of what we know of the general practice of how these texts were produced, drawing comparisons with figures like Ferdowsi, it seems likely that he had probably a New Persian source as well to work with. But in a sense, we have no direct evidence. We can only tease out the meanings of what he says in his preface to the degree that we can, and different scholars come to different conclusions. There are passing references to Veysel Ramin in both Arabic, mostly in Arabic literature, but not with enough detail to give us any sense that it was anything more than a well-known story, possibly transmitted orally.
Okay, thank you very much. Here's a question about stories coming down to Iran from the nomadic northern cousins called the Saka. Since it's now thought that aspects of the Shahnameh are from there, is there any relationship there?
I think there's probably a relationship insofar as this story seems to be associated, and here I'm having to draw back on my memories a bit, with the Eastern Iranian house of Godars. And a really good scholar for this is Jalal Halaghi Mudlaq, who has a book called Bijan o Manejeh o Veysel Ramin, not a book, an article, Bijan, comparing Bijan and Manejeh from the Shahnameh with Veysel Ramin. And he establishes that the Bijan and Manijeh story is so similar to Veysel Ramin in many of its aspects that they probably are from the same regional locale, milieu, and that this particular house is an Eastern Iranian house. Again, my familiarity with the Parthian landscape is kind of shaky, but I think he sort of situates it as part of like the Eastern Iranian households, which of course are also the same ones that seem to transmit or be the point of origin for the Sistani cycle. However, he does draw a distinction between the Sistani cycle and the Bijan and Manijeh and Veysel Ramin cycle. I think he traces them to different points of origin. So Eastern Iranian, yes, but perhaps not Sistani or Saka.
Thank you so much, Cameron. Can you share what the voice types were that vocalized the lyrics? I'm curious if it links to opera. Is Veysel Ramin at the beginnings of opera thinking of, sorry, is Veysel Ramin the beginnings of opera thinking about it being decentered?
What an interesting question. I just to confirm, I did check look up Lami'i's date. He's around 1351 CE. So that's when it was translated into Turkish. Now, opera, that's such an interesting question. Yes, I mean, one of the major interesting things I've run into when working through genre theory when applied to Persian literature, both in Persian and in English, has been the kind of reliance on just unquestioned categories of like epic, lyric, drama, right? These are kind of the holy trinity of literary criticism from going back to Hegel, right? And therefore, if you use this lens, you get to this weird conclusion that there is no drama in Persian, which is like that seems absurd to say. And I think it just betrays our own preconceptions around what we think we're looking for when we say a word like drama. And indeed, if you look at Vissa Ramin's lyrical passages, where we see Ramin acting sort of acting out the kind of a performance event in the text. The dramatization and the mise-en-scène, or if you will, is so carefully constructed. It's real, like you could stage some of these scenes because he tells you exactly where everyone's sitting, what the positionality of one figure to another, what the backdrop looks like, and it's not inert information either. It interacts with the performance itself. They talk to the element. So, like, you take the lyric convention, for example, of talking to the wind. Well, now you're in like an actual windstorm or something like that, and it actually plays a functional role in the story as it plays out. So, I think you could I sort of po gently pose the suggestion when in my discussion of in the Ramin chapter, and the snowstorm discussion that one can look at this again the same way one could look at this as like a novelistic text before the novel. You could also think about this as an operatic text before the opera, so to speak. You could use you we could rethink the kinds of terms we bring to bear in our discussion of non-Western literary conventions and texts, and use them as ways to look for richness and possibility that doesn't necessarily impose expectations around what it's supposed to look like that are gleaned from a Western canon, but rather forces us to rethink the term itself. That's where I hope that it can be kind of a useful two-way street, where it causes us to reflect on our own positionality as scholars and the assumptions we bring to a text. So the text is teaching us, but at the same time, we're using those lenses to look for to sort of appreciate new layers of meaning and richness in these texts. The same way that I'm suggesting we can use romance not as a given, but as a proposition for analysis.
Another question about the audience reaction to these tales. Is there any evidence of that, or any material on that whatsoever?
Yeah. Again, you can get some hints by looking at the audience the reception history. And again, Nuruzi's study is really fantastic on this. It's clear that this story rubs some people the wrong way. Like Iran Shah, Ibn Abil Khair, really hates this story. And my own article quotes what he says about it, so you can see it. But he says this is a story that froze men's hearts towards women. And instead of the adulterous wife getting a happy ending, he has his adulterous wife drawn and quartered and then thrown to the dogs. It's really horrific. And of course, Nezami also like heavily reworks a lot of the thematics of Vissa Ramin such that he takes the story in a different direction. And yet, I think that the claim that the story was universally despised or ignored is overblown, because Nuruzi's research shows the huge extent by to which this story was traveled and was quoted by many, many important poets. We know it traveled as far east as Japan in within 100 years of its having been written. And a figure like Rumi, for example, engages with Vissa Ramin in very complex ways, like in a way that's very appropriate for Rumi. He recognizes the ambivalence and the kind of I don't know, the richness and the inherent problems of their relationship, and he uses that in very interesting ways and in different ways. So it's not altogether to laugh at it or to disparage it or to praise it, but all of the above. So it's clear that Vissa Ramin and Khwaju Kermani also has really interesting reworkings of it. So it's clear that the text was carefully read. And then if you look at the Tazkirah tradition also later, even though it does eventually fall out of circulation by the time you get to the Timurid period, but one critic, Vale Dagestani, writes very favorably about it. He says, like, this is a gem, and he quotes a long section of it because he wants his readers to be aware of it. So it's a very rich reception history. It's not a uniform one. It has its detractors and proponents.
May I thank you once again for a really fascinating talk, which gathered a large number of people who are coming into this and were interested in it. A very nice discussion. And I was interested in, I'm going to close on my own volition here, of just talking about the notion of modernity and the novel and the focus in Persian literature on that. And this sort of makes me think how practically I can critique that in class for students by looking at antecedents to Persian literature on the Persian. So actually very practically useful as well. Thank
I'm
you
glad
to
to hear it.
everyone. Thank you to everyone, and may I thank everyone for attending. Once again, thank you to Cameron, and may I wish everybody a good morning or a good afternoon or a good evening wherever you happen to be. Thank you again. Bye-bye now.
Thank you so much. Take care.